You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello and welcome to yet another episode of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. It's episode number 26, if I'm counting correctly. It's not a prime number to keep that gag running. My name's Maga. At the other two ends of these complicated lines are Julie. Hello, Julie.
Hello.
And Matt. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
How are you doing, you two?
Yeah, fine.
Good.
Glad it's the weekend.
Yeah. Summer is over. I thought I would choose something completely different after the two Psycho podcasts. So I chose something that has absolutely nothing to do with Psychos, and that's adultery. I chose...
it's the adultery episode.
There might be similarities, but let's not get into that just yet. It's I chose In the Mood for Love by Wong Kar-wai, Hong Kong, 2000. I would very much claim to be up and hip with recent events, you know, the protests in Hong Kong, but I realized only in the middle of the movie that we were actually in Hong Kong. I don't have a crystal ball. I didn't foresee that. I didn't choose the movie for its
Hong Kongness.
For its Hong Kongness or for its political messages, if you like. Before we start, I'd like to make a small round. What have you seen, watched, played lately? Who wants to start? Matt?
Okay. I've been playing this game called Wolfenstein: The New Colossus, which already sounds great. It's basically, it is a B-movie in video game form, but it's actually kind of fitting and needed these days. Basically, it's you're set in this kind of alternative past where the Nazis have taken over the world, and you basically go and rid the world of Nazis one at a time, or if you've got a big enough gun, 10 at a time. It's trashy as hell. At the same time, it's actually kind of clever. It reminds me to some extent of something like The Man in the High Castle, because at some point you're on, you know, High Street America diners, and there's Ku Klux Klan members chatting with Nazis and being total fanboys over them. But there's also a kind of Tarantino-esque postmodern aspect to it. And they're definitely having fun with it. So I have to say that every now and then, I like getting out my shotgun and, you know, how is it that Brad Pitt put it, you know, killing some Nazis?
All right, that sounds like fun, yeah. No, I mean, I'm the guy who likes a little-known series called Blood Drive, so I sympathize with bloodshed and, you know. Julie, what have you seen, read, watched?
I watched Rocket Man, which is very atypical for me. But it came so warmly recommended by film critic Mark Kermode. I follow his podcast, and he really loved it. And one day I was like, I'm done with the world. I want to have some fun. Listen to some old songs. And I have to say, I really enjoyed it. I don't usually like musicals. I don't usually like biopics. But this had something. It's achronological. It's a scrapbook of images and sounds. It's cute. Jamie Bell is absolutely wonderful as the best friend. It's just a very nice, pretty movie with lovely music. And series-wise, season 2 of Mindhunter has been out for a bit now. So I've been re-watching season 1 in order to, you know, reboot myself for season 2. So, so that's been my bit this week, yeah.
All right.
How about you, Maga? What have you been up to culture-wise?
2 nights ago, I've been to see Battleship Potemkin. That's nothing new. I mean, you can watch it on YouTube. But there was a man who conducted a live orchestra. His name is Armin Brunner. He was astounded that Eisenstein, the director of the movie, and Shostakovich never collaborated in any way. Eisenstein was one of the greatest director of his time. Shostakovich, one of the greatest composers of his time. Shostakovich had experience in writing movie scores. He also played the live piano in movie theaters. So it's almost a no-brainer. Why didn't Shostakovich ever write music for Eisenstein? for instance, for a Battleship Potemkin. And that Armin Brunner, he took symphonies number 4 and 11. He basically used bits like in a quarry and underlined the scenes from Battleship Potemkin. And it works. Some of the scenes and the music just make an organic movie. It's like the music was written for the movie in a way. Mm-hmm. There's the undertitle for Battleship Potemkin is The Events of 1905. And that's almost verbatim one of the subtitle for one of the symphonies. So there is a small sliver of possibility that Shostakovich actually wrote at least part of the symphonies with the movie in mind. Nobody can prove that. He probably would never have said that because Stalin's eyes were already on him. He was in disfavor with the government. He had to watch his moves and what he said and what he did. But it's possible. And if you watch the movie, 75 minutes, the movie just dovetails with the music. It's astounding. Before they used Beethoven and Tchaikovsky, and nobody really liked that coupling. It never really worked. And with those two symphonies, that was wow. And it was live. It wasn't from a tape or anything. So it was fantastic. Very lovely evening.
That sounds like heaven. I love Shostakovich. Yeah. I've always loved Shostakovich mm-hmm. since my first sort of 8-year-old dabs at the piano. And of course, who doesn't love Eisenstein? So that sounds like sort of movie heaven to me. How wonderful. Really, really yes. cool.
It's so obvious to do that I'm really surprised that nobody did that before. Maybe somebody did. We just don't know or we don't remember. Yeah, no, that was a lovely evening.
I have to confess, I have not yet watched any Eisenstein. I'm sure I've seen at least 25 parodies of the Odessa Steps scene, mm-hmm. you know, from, I think The Untouchables to Brazil to The Simpsons to Naked Gun, but I have never seen the film itself, so perhaps I should remedy that.
That's your homework for next time, okay? Okay, thank you both. In the Mood for Love. Preparing for this episode, we all three found out that the East Asia movie scene, let's call it, none of us has that as a kind of specialty. Can I just ask which East Asian movies? I know it's a broad term. I wanted it to call Asian movies first, and it's even worse. You almost can't define it. Which East Asian movies have you seen? What's your experience with that area?
It's really dreadful. I started my love for Hong Kong cinema, specifically with the martial arts stuff. Mm-hmm. And I remember back in the day in Amsterdam, they were really, really hard to get a hold of. So we had this sort of boutique DVD shop who had these sort of outliers, and I used to go there and browse and try and pick up stuff. But, you know, it speaks to my ignorance that one of my favorites was Iron Monkey, which I absolutely love to this very day. Of course, I saw a lot, caught up with a lot of the old ones, but it's just dreadful how westernized my cinema palette really is when you get right down to it. I have a love for the genre. I have a love for Hong Kong movies, but you know, what do I even know at all about it? Except having a lot of love for them. My first experiences were basically the sort of classic type martial arts films.
Mm-hmm. All right. Matt?
I think with me, there's certain directors especially that I follow to some extent. I mean, of course, there's Akira Kurosawa. I think as a fan of the Criterion Collection, you don't get around, well, as a fan of cinema, you don't get around Kurosawa. And I've watched a bunch of his films. I still hope that at some point there will be a great, big, bulky collection of all of his films so I can do what I'm currently doing with Bergman, namely going through the whole collection. And then I'll never have to watch another film again, basically. There's, of course, the anime of Hayao Miyazaki and Isao Takahata. Things like Spirited Away, Grave of the Fireflies, I really love those. I love Kore-eda, who I think he won the, Palme d'Or last year with Shoplifters. And there's a Korean cinema I know. Again, it's basically certain directors. I cannot say that I know Korean cinema, but I've loved a lot of the films by Park Chan-wook, like Old Boy and The Handmaiden. I've actually just recently, a couple of nights ago, saw Bong Joon-ho's, I probably completely mispronounced that, Parasite, which won this year's Palme d'Or. And there's also Lee Jang-dong, who did Burning, for instance, which was quite a big hit, I think, at the festivals either last year or this year. So I know these directors, I would say that, you know, if something new comes out by them, I go and see it. But that's a bit like, you know, I can't claim that I know East Asian cinema based on following those directors. That would be like, you know, watching a couple of Fellinis and a couple of Rossellinis and then saying, I know Italian cinema. No, you don't.
Yeah. With me, it's, I think it's similar as with you, Matt, maybe to a significantly lesser degree. The only two or three movies I can remember, besides having chosen In the Mood for Love for today, is I've also seen Burning at the cinema, liked it a lot, and I watched Hidden Fortress by Kurosawa solely because they mention it in the end in one of the later episodes of Stranger Things Season 2. I'm bad. I'm really bad.
There's worse reasons to watch something.
I know, but you know... The only thing I knew about the movie is that George Lucas watched it and sort of based Star Wars on it. And then you see those two...
The peasants, yeah.
The two peasants, mercenaries bickering. And you realize after 20 seconds, you realize it's C-3PO and R2-D2 and that's it. And then you forget about Star Wars because Hidden Fortress becomes very much its own thing. And that was it. Yeah. Would you say that In the Mood for Love is a very Asian movie, or is it what kind of movie is it for you? I found it a very, very well mannered movie with covert, sometimes weird undertones. How about you? How would you summarize the movie?
It's for me, it's an Oscar shoo-in. That's one of the first things I thought was, look, you have to look up whether this won an Oscar. This is absolutely sort of the type of thing. I can't speak to whether it feels somehow Hong Kong-y. I have never been to Hong Kong. Sadly, I really want to go, but I've never been. But to me, there is this sort of glamour that you really, if you're me, you associate with Hollywood a lot. Very glamorous, very sort of romantic and dramatic and you know. So, yeah, for me, I just saw Oscars all over this film. This is a compliment. It's a compliment, you know. It should win all the awards. Yeah. Absolutely, because it's gorgeous. But that was sort of my Insta knee-jerk response, right?
I'm not sure whether it's really Oscar material. I mean, it is romantic, but it's also really rather melancholic. And on the surface, it is sort of not disappointing. That's too strong a word, but it's suspense. It's payoff in a way, doesn't it? So you wait for some kind of coda that never comes. And I am going out on a limb and say that it's not something that Americans like very much. You know, we've sat through a movie with subtitles. Now we want the payoff. So that doesn't happen. For those people, it's disappointing.
I don't know. It's still Hong Kong. I mean, it's quite a friendly, you know, an audience friendly film. I think Americans or British people, you know, they could get into it quite easily, much more easily than maybe some of the, you know, Japanese films or some of the Korean films who are very much their own thing. I think this one was a very sort of accessible film in that sense.
Yeah.
Or don't you agree with me?
Mm-hmm. I definitely think it's a Western influenced film. I think as far as I know, Wong Kar-wai is also a huge cineast. He loves watching films from around the world. And I think he also loves watching older Hollywood films, but also I think he's partly inspired by the French Nouvelle Vague. I don't know the French Nouvelle Vague broadly enough to say what kind of influence there would be in The Mood for Love. But I have to say that when I rewatched it, I think I've seen it about three times, always about 10 years apart. And this time around, when I watched it, there were two influences, or one influence and one kind of weird echo that came to my mind. The first thing that came to my mind was the weird echo, and that's Mad Men, which is, of course, the time that it's set at, you know, early 60s. But it's also, you know, to some extent, it's the clothes, it's the glamour, it's the colors. You could totally see Don Draper watching this and making notes on a little piece of paper or a napkin about which ad he could do next. I think it's the same kind of suits. It's when I looked at Maggie Cheung, the female lead, I thought, for instance, of Christina Hendricks' clothes that she wears very often in Mad Men. But the other thing that came to my mind was, weirdly enough, Billy Wilder's The Apartment, which is, I think it's the inference that comes also via Mad Men, because Mad Men has some kind of influence from The Apartment. It's, again, kind of 60s. It's this kind of sweltering, erotic atmosphere of adultery. The Apartment, of course, is a kind of melancholy comedy where I would say In the Mood for Love, it has some comical elements, but on the whole, it's much more straight melancholy. But I do think that the story of adultery that it tells, for the largest part, I find struck me as pretty universal and not specifically East Asian or Hong Kong. But that might also be partly due to some ignorance on my part of the culture and the cinema.
Mm. I should have done that earlier on. Let me just set the scene a little bit so everybody knows what In the Mood for Love is actually about. There is an apartment run by a landlady and her family, and there are two parties moving in, two married couples. We get to know Mr. Chow, played by Tony Leung. Excuse me for mispronouncing anything in this episode. And the other couple, we get to know the lady, Mrs. Chan, played by Maggie Cheung. We get to see the spouses, but only very spuriously from the back. The other husband barely has any lines, photographed from the back for a few seconds, and that's it. Eventually, very slowly, they realize that their respective spouses are absent at the same time, and they suspect them of having an affair. That's the setting. And then the role play starts. And that's, I think, the most fascinating bits are when they try to find out what their spouses try to do. On the one hand, it leads to nothing. I mean, you can role play all you want. You will never know what they're really up to. Where are they? What are they doing? You have no clue. You can role play all you want, but actually you can't help. You have to do it in a way. You want to know what your spouse does in your absence. And that fascinated the hell out of me. Mm-hmm. It was absolutely gorgeous. They sort of shift effortlessly from themselves into the role of their spouses. And they say things like, I never thought it would hurt like that. And there are two layers of that. Are they right now commenting on the affair? Are they role playing, or are they talking about the affair that they might have, which they will never do? But there is a tendency to sort of have an affair too, not as a payback, but because they are attracted to each other in a way. Do you see it also that way, many layer? What did you make of the role play in general?
Who would not be attracted? I mean, these two people are probably the most beautiful people on screen. The role play is interesting. It speaks a lot to control. If you look at her characterization, she is very controlled. Her hair is beautifully coiffed. Her dresses are high-necked, very high-necked dresses. This is not, and they fit like a glove, right? So on the one hand, it's this really sort of almost demure look. On the other hand, there's definitely sexiness going on there, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And I think the role playing, in a way, it's all they have. It's interesting when they go into the martial arts comic that they're making together, right? This is a point in which the safeties of this role playing sort of teeters and threatens to fall down, where they're actually making a real connection aside from the affair that they think is happening between their spouses and not themselves. And this is where I think it was her immediately says, we have to stop. Right. This is also, I think, the first time you actually see her character smile or laugh in the entire film. And this is where it gets dangerous. So to me, the role playing is an instrument of control for them both to keep things from becoming what they will inevitably become, love. Right. Mm-hmm. It's inevitable, but they try to play their cards close to their chest and they try to keep it into this role-playing thing. And of course, in the end, they cannot. So that's what it means to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, I find it fascinating the way it's played out in the film. you don't get a scene where the two of them say, let's do this, let's actually enact, what did they say? I'm curious about that. Let's see if we can get to the truth through play acting. It's basically, we get a scene where they have a conversation that at first seems a bit strange, you know. They've met each other already, so what are they doing? Are they flirting? Are they pretending? What is it they're pretending? And then you realize the moment that they basically break off the first role play, you realize that she, I think it's probably her, it would have come from her that she would have suggested, I wonder how they got together. Let's pretend it. Let's play out that scene. And I agree that it's first and foremost about control, but it's also, it's, as you said, it's futile. It's doomed to fail. Because in doing so, for one thing, they're not only never going to get at the truth of what happened, just like we never see the spouses conducting their affair or at any other time. They're never going to know, was it like that or was it completely different? And of course, what they're enacting is they're enacting a seduction and an affair. And the longer you play something, the longer you pretend something, the more that pretense starts to feel real. So I think in trying to control it, they in a way doom themselves to repeat at least some of the romance and become those lovers. But of course, they never want to become those lovers. They say, I think she also says that we're not going to be like them. She says it twice. And the first time it seems like she's convinced of that. The second time it seems slightly desperate. We're not going to become like them at a point where they've probably already fallen for each other.
Mm-hmm. I think they're on one level, they're in some kind of deadlock. They can't go forward with their affair because that would make them as bad as their spouses morally. But they have feelings and they want to act on those feelings. So they can't go forward, they can't go back. And I think that's their, not downfall, but I think that's their drama, isn't it? And I don't find the movie all that glamorous. I mean, we are watching two beautiful people and do beautiful things in the rain or something like that. The dresses are wonderful. The hair is very nice and everything, and the suits impeccable. But there is that sort of drabness in the street. There is some kind of claustrophobia going on. There are many shots through some sort of latticed windows or down a corridor or a drab street with half torn off posters, maybe political posters. The stairs down to the noodle shop is sort of, it's basically a wet tunnel, isn't it? So glamour, yeah, there is glamour, but it's definitely not so much in the surroundings. It's in the people, how they dress and how they behave, their stance, their, maybe even their work ethic is sort of, that also reminded me of The Apartment, because there is also a boss who organizes his afternoon trysts from the office, right? It's obvious the parallels. Yes. So glamorous, yeah, maybe not that much. But of course, it is a love, a dramatic love story, yeah.
Did you notice, this is something that I wrote down and I couldn't, once I saw it, I couldn't let go of it. She always wears the same exact dress, only it's different fabric.
Okay, yeah.
The model of the dress with the high neck and the slinky sort of just, I think it's just below the knee cut, is the exact same dress throughout the entire film. And it's interesting because I was like, what is this supposed, this is supposed to signify something. This is not an accident. Is this supposed to signify that she makes her own dresses, for instance? And she has the same pattern with several fabrics. So fabrics are referenced a couple of times, especially in the beginning of the movie. There has to be something there. And I couldn't put my finger on. I think it's just supposed to signify that there's a very glamorous look. But then she still makes her own, has to make her own clothes or something like that. But I couldn't put my finger on it. I wonder if you spotted it, because, you know, it's maybe a very girly thing to have for me to have spotted.
No, I mean, I spotted that the make of the dress was always the same. And on the one hand, it is, it looks impenetrable in a way. It's like sometimes it shines like scales or something. At the same time, it's so skin tight that the female form is basically, it's there. It's not some kind of amorphous bag. It's skin tight, and you can see how the character is basically built. But yes, the cut of the dress is always the same. That really severe color around the throat is really. I asked myself whether that really hurt and if it gives you a headache. But it's really quite. It's no less a uniform than what the man wears, I think. I don't know whether that's the mores of the times or if that's intended by the filmmakers, and maybe it was different in the 60s in Hong Kong. I have no idea of knowing. But there is something severe about those dresses, and they're beautiful at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely the kind of dresses I also remember seeing in some Vietnam films or films of basically the Indochina War, where you'd have Vietnamese women wearing those kind of dresses. And it's basically what you said earlier, Julie. It's this mix of, it is controlled, it is demure, and at the same time, it's utterly erotic. I mean, as you said, Maga, it molds her and it displays her while at the same time not revealing her. It reveals and doesn't reveal her, and that in itself does reveal something about her. You mentioned, I can't remember which one of you was, it was you, Julie, who said that the dress fits like a glove. That's absolutely there. Apart from what it says about the characters, it totally plays into the relationship between the two of them. It's like there's this constant, almost threat of, you know, sex breaking out, so to speak. It's the two of them obviously are infatuated with each other, and I think the camera is infatuated with them. Maggie, you said that thing about the glamorous, you didn't say it like that, but I think the glamour is focused especially on them, because I think the camera falls in love with them as well. As you said, Julie, how can you not be attracted to them? They are gorgeous, the two of them. They are gorgeous in how they're presented. And I think they're also gorgeous because they seem unattainable. And that adds to the eroticism. It's this, you want this, but you can't have it. You shouldn't have it, but you still want it. There's this constant tension there where if she let her hair down, if they got undressed, if they had the affair in front of us, so much of that tension would be gone in an instant. Yet at the same time, you want them to get together because they're both unhappy. Their spouses are, you know, two-timing them. Their spouses obviously don't care about them as much as they become, as they get to care about each other. So I'm not sure whether that is a Western or Westernized perspective, but I wanted the two of them to get together because I thought they might be able to make each other happy. But at the same time, if they did get together, they would no longer be the people that you kind of become infatuated with.
But also what's interesting is they have this beautiful scene where they're trapped. They're trapped in this room together because the landlady is playing mahjong and they don't want to, you know, they don't want to have any kind of intimacy, any kind of physical intimacy, because again, moral issues. And then she has to sneak out really weird in her, you know, in her own place. And I was thinking, you know, for all intents and purposes, for the outside world, they might as well. Why don't they? Because everybody else is going to gossip. Everybody else is going to look. Everybody else is going to think things and judge them. So why adhere to this very strict moral principle when, you know, it's almost a moot point? And I think it's much cleverer than that. I think that is part of the attraction. But if it were ever consummated, as you say, it would be lost. It would be like crushing a butterfly.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Right?
It's basically also, it's one of the things that attracts them to each other, that they are not the kind of people who would just have an affair, however casual or not. So it's, they're in a double bind, basically.
Yes. I've seen at least two posters for the movie where the two actors touch, and they don't touch in the movie. I can't remember one scene that they don't even shake hands.
I think when they're in the taxi, very briefly,
they touch the fingertips or the shoulders or something like that. Something completely innocent and almost random.
And of course, she keeps bursting into tears on him. Right?
True.
She keeps crashing, crumbling into his shoulder, sobbing, because the role playing is basically too much for her, and she can't. So in that sense, they touch, but not in the sense that you mean, like on the movie poster, right?
Yeah, there is one poster where Maggie Cheung lies across Tony Leung's lap. And that's just, people, if you watch the movie and wait for that scene, you'll be sorely disappointed. And there is one other poster where the man embraces the woman by standing behind her. Doesn't happen, guys. Forget it. It's not some kind of lush brief summer affair over in 3 months. Forget about it. It's different. It's completely different.
Yet at the same time, I mean, there's, before they actually start going into the role play during the first third of the film or so, what happens very often is that she goes to that noodle place, gets her noodles, comes up the stairs as he goes past her to get the noodles, and they don't touch. You're absolutely right. But in a way, their erotic aura almost rubs against each other. You hear the screen crackling with electricity as they are half a meter apart, because there's a part of you that wants them to touch, not because you want to see sex on screen or anything, but it's just aesthetically these people are made for each other.
Yeah. And the movie also makes it sort of harder for us to not see them getting together by using that repeated melody, that bum, 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 bum. And then the movie goes into slow motion, and at least the first two or three such inserts, they show us basically the male gaze looking at women. Predominantly, of course, looking at Mrs. Chan, but also there are also other women in the picture. But the focus lies on Mrs. Chan, of course. But the male gaze there is sort of not leading up to anything. It's not preparing us for anything. It's happy sort of looking at Mrs. Chan in slow motion, and then it's done. That's even underlined by the repetitiveness of the melody in a way. We're going to look at the female form, and then it's over. There's nothing more. There's nothing. It's not some kind of foreplay to another scene. Not at all. Did you see that the same way, those 7 or 8 inserts with the same melody?
Yeah, certainly. It's a very famous theme, even. And of course, Nat King Cole, the perhaps, perhaps, perhaps in Spanish.
Yes, exactly.
Which is, underlines sort of the theme of the entire movie, because perhaps, but perhaps, you know, I guess not. So, and the gaze, just a little bit of a tangent, but we have not yet mentioned the gorgeous cinematography of this. And it would be a shame to not mention that, because basically you could take a screenshot at any point in the film and frame it for your living room. It is just that perfect. It is that beautiful. It's incredible. And I try to pay a little bit of attention about how the camera looks at them. And I almost feel like it's his memory of that time with her. As he says right at the end, he remembers those years as they're looking through a dusty window pane or something. And within the cinematography, you see them, as you said, Maga, shot through windows, through corridors, in reflections even. So to me, the gaze of the camera, the gaze of the film is very definitely his, but that is my interpretation, but that's how I feel about it.
I have to say I also thought something along those lines, and that's one of the things I actually don't like that much about the film. I think for me, the film works best when it treats the two of them almost equally. It's when it isn't primarily his perspective. And I think especially while they try to kind of reenact role play their spouse's affair, they are both kind of equal partners in this film. I do agree that the camera, to some extent, I think the camera is more his gaze than hers. Although I think you get a couple of glamour shots of him, but it is just different because, you know, as sexy as he looks in those suits, in those 60s suits, it is not the same thing because it's not as figure hugging. It's not as revealing of the male form as her dresses are of the female form. In the end, in the last 10 minutes or so of the film, I think we end on him and just his perspective. And I found that decidedly weaker, because I think the two of them work best when they are equal partners in not just their is it an affair, isn't it, but also in the film. It works less well for me when it becomes his film to some extent.
I think that's because in the view of the film, a film doesn't have an opinion. But in the view of the film, he wants them to be very much. He wants them to be collaborators in his martial arts comic strip for the paper, which she keeps sort of dodging. She keeps saying, no, I'm not no good at it or whatever. She keeps dodging that. And I think a lot of what works in this film for me is the respect they have for each other, and the fact that he is the one who wants them to be on a more equal footing. And she keeps shrugging that off as something that is ultimately impossible, right? And this is a reversal that I think works really, really well. And the film is absolutely, I agree with you, 100% at its best when it looks at that side of this history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The end didn't work for me at all because it's sort of it's almost a cop-out. For the longest time, they are sort of trapped in those streets, in the apartments, in the room. Sometimes they're physically trapped if the old people don't know when to stop playing Mahjong. There's that kind of claustrophobia, very soft claustrophobia that sort of prompts them to act or not act. They have to do something. They have to make decisions. And then the movie sort of opens up and I think it's sort of watered down and it's mainly his perspective. And I would agree with you too, yeah, that the movie is at its best when they're in a room together or if they're close but don't see each other or when they think about each other or something like that. The end is sort of it also has unnecessary political stuff. I mean, the room number 2046, it's deeply political. And it's also the title of Wong Kar-wai's next movie, isn't it? So, yeah, it should have ended in another way, in a more... I don't know how, but not not by traveling. It's sometimes I found the movie sort of labyrinthine. You don't know what's going on. You don't know what's in the next street or around the next corner. And then he starts to travel and it becomes a different movie. Nah. But for as long as it went on in Hong Kong in 1962, that was fantastic. Okay, guys, last question. Do you like the title? In the Mood for Love? I mean, there are moments where I thought, how can you use a title like that? I mean, it's sort of... Sometimes I think it's meant to be cynical or at the expense of that couple that never really find each other. And it's sort of it's cynical. How do you see that? In the Mood for Love? It should be some kind of comedy, you know, but I don't know, Ewan McGregor and Renée Zellweger, what do I know? But it's not. It's. I think at some point the joke's on them in the Mood for Love. Yeah, it's not a mood thing. It's sort of life changing what they have to go through. So do you like the title? Because I'm not fully happy with the title at all.
No, it should be called Escaping Isolation or something, you know? Or attempting to escape isolation. It should not be In the Mood for Love because there's nothing about any mood for love. There's a lot of moodiness, but this has nothing to do because they don't have agency over their love.
Mm-hmm.
If they had a choice at all, it may be called In the Mood for Love, but they don't. The whole point of the movie is that they do not have a choice. The choice is made for them by society, by context, by social pressure. And they do not have a choice either about their feelings or how they will play out. So I don't understand how you can call this movie In the Mood for Love rather than Escaping the Isolation or something equally dour.
Yeah.
I don't have that problem. I mean, for one thing, in the original, the title might be different. The connotations might be different. The feel might be different. So I think it is a translated title. And as such, I find it difficult to talk about, you know, what were they thinking of when they chose that title. But I also think it works quite well for me because it sounds like it could be the title of one of those Nat King Cole songs. And then it could easily be the song about a couple or a person who is in love, who wants love, but it doesn't happen. I mean, a lot of these songs are torch songs, basically. And it's a film about two people carrying torches. It's romantic, but it's also romantic in an old-fashioned way, in the way that it doesn't happen. If you look at a number of these old-time films, it's also, what's the David Lean film about the affair that doesn't actually happen?
Brief Encounter.
I think that's it, yeah. I think it fits in with an older time where the romance doesn't necessarily lie in the affair being consummated. But I agree also, there's an ironic, if not sarcastic, touch there. There's a sadness in that, you know, they are in the mood for love, we are in the mood for love, but we're forever going to be blocked from that. So I think there is a bitter touch there, but I think I don't mind that. I think it can easily have that and work as that. I wouldn't call it cynical, but I would say that it prepares us for something, but the mood is never consummated, so it never becomes anything other, anything more. It cannot. I kind of like that.
Mm. If the title refers to a Nat King Cole song that doesn't exist, I can very well live with that. But I also like what you said, Julie, that maybe we could give it a title like something with the butterfly crushed or anything. Or a butterfly that doesn't get crushed specifically. But I can't think of a snazzy title.
Titles are the worst thing to think of anyway. So
yeah.
I'm just happy I didn't have to think of a title.
Well, why not call it Perhaps, Perhaps, Perhaps? Right? As the song is in the film so prominently, why just not call it Perhaps?
Yeah, but I think then you get people saying, should we go and see that film? And they go, perhaps.
All right. That's it. That was podcast number 26 in the Mood for Love. Thank you very much, Julie. Thank you very much, Matt, for being here, talking about it. I also thank our listeners. Hear from you. See you in a month's time. Until then, see good movies, read good books, play nice games.
Shoot some Nazis.
Shoot some Nazis, but be in the mood for love anyway. And don't crush any butterflies. Catch you later. Goodbye, guys.
See ya. Bye.
Bye.